You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 26th of November 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Dominic Reynolds, and Phil Hahn.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, Raffaello Pantucci from the Royal United Services Institute is here to set the day's agenda. Raffaello, what are we talking about today?
Well, today we're going to talk about more of the Snowden fallout, this time in Malaysia, between Malaysia and Singapore. We're going to talk about Pakistan launching its own drones. And we're going to have a stock take of Obama and how real and effective has his diplomatic push been.
We will hear more from Raffaello shortly. Also on the programme, Angela Merkel's Conservatives and the opposition Social Democrats are entering the final stages of coalition talks. We'll ask what the country's government might end up looking like once they get to an agreement.
Also ahead, we'll find out how Vienna managed to save its flood-prone city from the Danube River.
The island is still free of building development, and it's accessible for everybody, and it's definitely a success.
Also coming up, that is the sound of New Bedford, the town, of course, where Herman Melville set Moby Dick to discover the grim reality of modern industry fishing, as two anthropologists have portrayed in their documentary Leviathan.
The sound, the persistent, loud engine noise was very nerve-wracking for everybody, you know? Not only us. I think the fishermen are also suffering from that.
So all that, plus we check in with our man in Belgrade. We're going to take a look at this morning's European front pages, and we may even play some music as well. That's all to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
It would be foolhardy in the extreme to miss any of the next 58 minutes of today's Midori House. We will start, as ever, with the world news headlines. Here's Barney Burnham.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. President Obama has taken on domestic critics of a newly brokered nuclear deal with Iran. Top Republicans, as well as America's ally Israel, have criticised him for agreeing to the deal, which the US and its partners say will prevent Tehran from obtaining a nuclear bomb. The president said tough talk was good for politics, but not good for US security. Following the announcement of the deal, the price of oil fell sharply. Mike Ingram, a market commentator from BGC Partners, said there was concern about what Israel would do, but that lower oil prices were good for everyone outside the Middle East.
The wild card there remains the fact that Israel clearly reserves the right to take unilateral action. I mean, they're not going along with this deal whatsoever. In a broader sense, as I already mentioned, lower oil prices are good for global equity, and at the economic level, they're good for just about every single country outside of the Middle East and Nigeria. So it's generally positive news for risk assets.
The United Nations Deputy Secretary General Jan Eliasson has called on the Security Council to consider the deployment of UN peacekeeping forces to the Central African Republic. The African Union has deployed a peacekeeping mission known as MISCAR in the country, and it's bolstered by French troops. Mr. Eliasson says that mission now needs further bolstering as the area has become a breeding ground for extremists and armed groups, which could have disastrous consequences for the entire region.
The transformation of MISCAR into a United Nations peacekeeping operation with an estimated strength of 6,000 troops and 1,700 police personnel would lay the foundation for transparent, accountable and resilient institutions. A United Nations peacekeeping operation would ensure a multidimensional, integrated approach and enhance the international community's ability to apply political leverage, we would hope.
The jailed Ukrainian opposition leader and former Prime Minister Yulia Tymoshenko has gone on hunger strike to push President Viktor Yanukovych into signing a landmark trade agreement with the European Union. Thousands of protesters have taken to the streets of the capital Kiev since the government announced it wouldn't be signing the free trade agreement, but would instead be renewing trade talks with Russia. Ukraine had been due to sign the agreement this week. An official report into last year's school shooting in Newtown, Connecticut, has found that the gunman was obsessed with the 1999 massacre at Columbine. After killing his mother, Adam Lanza went on to kill 20 young children and 6 adults at Sandy Hook Elementary School on the 14th of December last year before turning his gun on himself. The report said Lanza had a familiarity with and access to firearms and ammunition and an obsession with mass murders, in particular the April 1999 shootings at Columbine High School in Colorado, in which 2 teenagers killed 12 students and a teacher. The report said Lanza's motive could not be established and the case was now closed. Documents published by the Roman Catholic Church in Scotland have revealed details of abuse allegations made between 2006 and 2012. The statistics showed that more than half of the 46 allegations of abuse filed over the 6-year period were made against priests, and some 55% of the total allegations were of a sexual nature. The church said it would carry out an audit of its archives dating back to 1947. It'll alert the police if any evidence of abuse by priests being covered up over the last 60 years is found. Delegates at the annual meeting of the International Commission for the Conservation of Atlantic Tunas in Cape Town have agreed on freezing fishing quotas for bluefin tuna in 2014. The Commission, which has 46 member countries, including the European Union, discussed catch quotas and other conservation measures for tuna and tuna-like species of fish in the Atlantic and the Mediterranean. The World Wildlife Fund welcomed the decision to keep the quota unchanged. Sergei Tudelas Casanovas is the head of the WWF's Mediterranean Fisheries Programme.
This year there was not any new scientific information, and the scientific recommendations for this year was to maintain the quota adopted last year. So fortunately for the credibility of ICAT, ICAT has decided to stick to science when it comes to the management of the Eastern Atlantic and Mediterranean bluefin tuna this year.
Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Barney, thank you very much. It is 7 minutes past 8 in the morning here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Welcome back. You're listening to Midori House live from Studio One here in London. It's time now for us to set the day's news agenda with the 3 big stories you'll need to know for the next 24 hours. Well, joining us now in the studio is Raffaello Pintucci of the Royal United Services Institute here in... It's a tricky little title,
isn't it? It's a tough one, isn't it? That's why you have a charming acronym, RUSI.
I'll just say RUSI. Raffaello Pintucci from RUSI. Welcome to the show, Raffaello, as always. Shall we begin with the continuing spy row that's now reached the shores of Asia?
Yes. Well, this is a story that's initially been published by Reuters, but it reflects, you know, reporting that we've seen out in Malaysia and Singapore. And the Malay government has called the Singaporean High Commissioner, which is, you know, their equivalent to our ambassador, to complain about the fact that there were reports that the city-state Singapore was helping U.S. intelligence agencies spy on Malaysian authorities. You know, this is more of the sort of fallout that we're seeing from Snowden. The root of all this is more Snowden documents, of course. And Singapore, you know, does see itself as a very close U.S. ally in the region. I would also emphasize that it comes on the back of another story that we saw in the Australian press, which claimed that Indonesian and Chinese spies were operating together to spy on Australian and US assets. You know, I think this is the Snowden affair has obviously upturned a whole lot of tables. And I think the interesting thing that's showing up now is it's showing up lots of sort of interesting intelligence relationships that we may have not known about or may have thought existed but didn't really have confirmation of. And now we're getting it. We've seen this across Europe and it's caused all sorts of tensions here. And now we're seeing the same impact in Asia.
Well, Indonesia and Australia in their sort of spying back and forth, well, it is a bit of a spying back and forth, isn't it? Because this latest line is Indonesia with Chinese help is spying on the Aussies. But this comes after pretty much the exact reverse a couple of weeks ago. I mean, I guess it begs the question, should we just not presume that everyone's spying on everyone and then move on slightly?
Well, I mean, my sense of this whole story was that this whole element of, you know, government spying on each other, it was always a bit of a moot point. I mean, of course they do that. We all know this. We all assume this. I mean, we've all seen James Bond movies, right? But I think...
Oh, those are all true.
Well, what do you think? I mean, but, you know, so I think that the sort of expectation of government spying each other isn't surprising. The element that I always thought was more important was the whole question of the domestic spying and the volumes that we're seeing done by the NSA and GCHQ here in the UK.
and how much information they were gathering on each and every individual citizen who, in theory, was innocent until proven guilty. So I think that was the biggest sort of ethical dilemma, this whole question about tit for tat between different countries. I mean, frankly, it's been going on for a long time. But, you know, I think that this is probably something we're going to continue to see reverberate over at least the next few months as we continue to see more of these sort of Snowden documents coming out.
But how unusual, Rafael, is it that you're starting to see these espionage alliances forming, you know, the Chinese working with the Indonesians, the Australians working with the Americans? Is this a worrying trend?
I don't think it's a new trend, to be honest with you. I mean, in the UK, US alone, there's the famous Five Eyes Treaty, which is, you know, the New Zealanders, the Canadians, the Americans, the Brits, and the, I'm forgetting the fifth
French,
one.
No,
it's not the French, actually. It's another English-speaking one. I can't remember which one. There was discussion that the French wanted to join, but then never actually did because for whatever reasons. But so you've always got these sorts of alliances. And then I know the relationship between the NSA and the Germans, for example, has been very close. And so, you know, in seeing these same sort of relationships in Asia, it's not really that surprising. I mean, I know that the US, Korea, Singapore, and Japan cooperate very closely on intel stuff. I mean, clearly this is kind of seen as targeted against China, and frankly speaking, it probably is. But then, you know, so it's not surprising that the Chinese are developing their own sort of relationships regionally. The Indonesians have been one of the Southeast Asian countries that they've been able to have a more productive relationship with. And, you know, we've seen recent visits by Xi Jinping to lots of these countries, Malaysia and Singapore, and Malaysia and Indonesia, in fact. You know, and so part of having a sort of a covert side to that relationship is not entirely surprising.
Well, speaking of covertness, let's look to the skies above Pakistan. There are drones in the air, but for once, they don't belong to the US.
Yes, the we've been hearing a lot about this for a few years now. The Pakistanis have been trying to develop their own indigenous drone capacity to have their own sort of assets so they can fly over their territory, so they can, you know, stop having American ones there. You know, if we're talking about intelligence relationships here, of course, the story is that these drones were developed with Chinese help, of course. You know, China and Pakistan have a very close relationship at every level, covert and overt. But, you know, finally, the Pakistanis have managed to get them going and have got some now flying around the drones are called Burak and Shaharpur, but presumably they're going to start using these in their northwest frontier provinces and, you know, rely less on American intelligence support in this sort of asset, something that's very contentious in Pakistan.
And finally, Rafaela, we're still discussing, of course, the fallout from the Iranian nuclear deal, but a broader issue about President Obama's role in all of this and whether he's finally now going to get some of those big wins he's been hoping for.
Well, I mean, you know, I think this pending potential sort of success with Iran is going to be the foreign policy legacy of this president, if it sort of comes to pass and we see a denuclearized Iran and we see everything sort of calming down. I think that sort of a shift would be the big thing which the history books will write about. The question is this a new trend? I mean, the Obama administration has been very big in pushing out the line that this was something that the president said he was going to do when he first came into office. And we're now getting reports out that, in fact, you know, State Department officials had been meeting with their Iranian counterparts in a sort of covert way for at least a year, maybe before, which would suggest that there was a greater effort on the sort of diplomatic front. I think this is also reflected in other ways as well. I think it's interesting if you look at the volume of drone strikes that the Americans are doing. They've cut it back substantially. Now, on the one hand, there's an argument to be said that maybe they're running out of targets and it's just no one left to get anymore. But on the other hand, I think it's, you know, it is a choice that they've made. They've decided to tone this down. We see them being used in a much more selective and rare manner. And I think that's part of a general push by the U.S. administration. This was never a president who wanted to be seen as a war president. I think this is why we've seen him not go be in the forefront of Libya, not get involved in Syria. He was very much about, let's get out of the two wars I inherited and let's, you know, rebuild America's image in the world.
I mean, to play devil's advocate, does it really take 6 years to undo the legacy of the previous administration?
I think that's a very good question. And I think that's what really lies under a lot of this. I mean, even if we say, even if we follow the administration's line that, you know, the president had come in saying he was going to reach out to his enemies and then that he'd allowed these discussions, that was only going back a year or so. So it's still 5 years where what exactly were we doing? You know, the Iranian regime has, you know, repeatedly made overtures of one sort or another. You know, it's true that it's not totally clear how genuine they are, but I think it does need to be commended, the fact that there has been an ability to recognize that Rouhani regime coming into Iran is an opening, and it's an opening they've been able to capitalize on quite well.
And you mentioned there just earlier that, you know, Obama didn't want to go in as the wartime president. He wanted to rebuild America's image abroad. But do you think he's been able to do that quite successfully? You know, if you look at his role in Syria, it's been completely absent. He's been criticized across both, you know, across the spectrum, saying he hasn't done enough. He hasn't shown leadership. The Israeli-Palestinian conflict continues to go on. So has he really done enough to really rebuild America's image?
I wonder about that. I think that, you know, this specific story that we're seeing in the New York Times is kind of capturing a moment, which I think is exactly here and now. Now, I think you're right. It still remains to be seen. We still don't know how this Iranian deal is going to play out. We still don't know what the end game with Syria is. And you're right. We still have had no resolution in Israel-Palestine, which continues to go on. We've seen a worsening relationship with the U.S. and Saudi Arabia. The Saudis are getting quite angry about this sort of warming U.S.-Iranian relationship because they're concerned about it. And they worry about a lot of the things which we've been talking about. So I think it is still too early to say. However, I do think that if going forward the Obama administration leaves office with a U.S.-Iranian relationship with leaders on a talking basis, that will be a major shift.
Excellent stuff, Raffaello. Raffaello Pantucci of the Royal United Services Institute here in London. RUSI for short.
There we go. You should just, in future, just straight to RUSI.
No, I can do it.
It's like an intelligence test. If you can say it, you can be involved. Coming up, we're in Germany to discuss the ongoing coalition talks between Merkel's centre-right and the Social Democrats.
Oyuna, Comme des Garçons, Armadillo, Porter. The Monocle shops feature carefully curated collections from brands around the world, consisting of unique and exclusive collaborations with Monocle's designers and editors, as well as every issue of Monocle, right back to issue one. Hong Kong, London, New York and Toronto, the Monocle shops cover all your travel, home, sartorial and reading needs. Go to monocle.com/shop to explore more.
Welcome back to Midori House, where the time is 9:16 in Berlin, 8:16 a.m. here in London. But it is to Germany that we're headed now. It's been more than 2 months since Angela Merkel and her Christian Democrats won in German elections, taking with them just over 41% of the vote. But while it was a strong win for the Chancellor, it still fell short of the necessary majority she was hoping for. That's led to weeks of intense negotiations to find a coalition partner.
Now, the most likely candidate for the Christian Democrats will be the Social Democrats. The final round of negotiations finished up at about 1 a.m. this morning in London, and they are expected to meet again later today for a final round of talks. So how likely will these two ideologically opposed parties get together? Well, joining us now on the line is Werner Patzelt from Dresden University of Technology. Welcome to the program, Werner. Lots of long hours being spent at the negotiating table. What's your sense? Will we get a deal later today?
We will get a deal today, but the open question is whether the membership of the Social Democratic Party will accept this deal.
And do you think they will?
Well, this is an open question because the Social Democrats are split over the question whether they should enter a coalition government with the Christian Democrats or not, because most Social Democrats feel that they suffered strongly from the last grand coalition, because whatever went well in this coalition was attributed to the Christian Democrats, while the Social Democrats, as they see it themselves, did the hard work, but the profit was given to the Christian Democrats. And so they are quite reluctant to re-enter a new coalition government.
Well, such always is the sort of poison chalice, I suppose, of being the minor partner in a coalition government. Talk to us, Werner, about the issues on which concessions are going to need to be made.
Well, first of all, the Social Democrats wanted to see increases in taxes in Germany, what the Christian Democrats would not like to do, and as it seems, there won't be any increases in taxes. The second central issue was whether minimal wages would be introduced in Germany, which was a central demand of the Social Democrats, and the Christian Democrats seem to have accepted it. And the third major issue has been whether government money for families, which was introduced by the Christian Democratic Liberal government, would be maintained. The Social Democrats wanted to have his funding programs cancelled, but they won't get their will in this way. So these were the major points, and it seems that the parties will have found a solid compromise on that.
You mentioned a lot of big spending items, some big ticket items there. New spending in this new coalition agreement would roughly total about 60 billion euros, but according to Merkel's budget platform, she would only have 15 billion euros in new spending to spend. So how likely will it be that this kind of agreement will even be able to go ahead?
Well, if you look back at the process of these coalition negotiations, it was set up in a way that first working groups were writing down whatever Christian Democrats or Social Democrats wanted to have, and this ended up in a strong increase in public expenditure. But always a list was set up in the Ministry of Finance to find out whether these desires could really be fulfilled in practice. And it became clear in the last days that after the first phase of writing down whatever might be desirable for whatever reason, now the time for accepting reality as it is has come. And so these last round of negotiations will end up in cutting down the desires for expenditures. And it will be done quite sharply, because the Christian Democrats have clearly stated that there won't be any tax increases.
I mean, on whose sort of table would it fall, at whose desk, if there was a deal wasn't to be reached? I mean, whose fault would it be? And presumably, said party would be judged pretty harshly for what would be a paralysis of German politics.
Well, if this coalition formation would fail, it would clearly be the Social Democrats on whom the blame would be put, because it will be the membership of the Social Democratic Party which now will be asked whether the party should enter this coalition. And if they decline this, the failure of these negotiations is clearly due to the Social Democrats. This is what Social Democrats know. This is why the party chair, Sigmar Gabriel, has clearly told to his party that all members who participate in this intra-party vote should behave as if they were chairpersons of the Social Democratic Party. Everybody knows if this coalition negotiation fails, we will end up in new elections. And the central topic of these elections will be on whom the blame must be put for the failure of these negotiations. And in the German public, there is no doubt that the Social Democrats will have not contributed enough for a successful end of these negotiations.
I mean, there's a lot of posturing that goes on during a process of arranging a coalition like this, isn't there? I mean, presumably both sides need to behave as if they could do without a deal if it really came to that.
Well, that's true, but we are in an unusual situation. Usually, either the center-right bloc or the Social Democrat-Green camp won a majority in the parliament. This was not the case during the last election, so we are in an absolutely new situation. The Christian Democrats lost their liberal partner. A red-green coalition could not be formed for mathematical reasons. And both the Greens and the Social Democrats were quite reluctant to enter a coalition government with the Christian Democrats. So it has been an open situation, and therefore leading politicians had to do some posturing because doing the obvious was not possible in such a non-obvious situation.
Werner Patzelt, Professor of Comparative Government in the Political Science Department of Dresden University of Technology. Thank you very much for joining us here on Midori House.
Stand back from your letterboxes and tone up your biceps, because the biggest ever issue of Monocle is about to hit subscribers' doormats and newsstand shelves. The December-January issue helps you bid farewell to 2013 and look over the horizon to 2014 with our soft power survey, the Monocle 100, and our travel top 50.
In the affairs section, we sit down for a series of interviews with global heavy hitters, from the President of Chile to the Australian Foreign Minister. We take a look at the Mexican President's to-do list, look at Japan's agenda for 2014, and ask 10 writers, academics and economists to give us their predictions for the year to come.
In the business section, we visit three model factories that are working inspirations for their industries. From a shoelace factory in Hanover built by the early modernist Walter Gropius, to a restored Renaissance village in Umbria making knitwear, and a Japanese brand that's so transparent, its customers are invited to pitch their tents on the lawn outside. These are companies who've created beautiful, light-filled environments for their production lines and are reaping the benefits as a result.
The Monocle December-January double issue is on newsstands now.
It is 12:24 in Abu Dhabi, 8:24 a.m. here in London, or 3:24 a.m. if you're in Washington, D.C., having a sleepless night. You are listening to Midori House with me, Dominic Reynolds, and that laughing man, Phil Hahn.
Time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. And today we're speaking to our man in Belgrade, Guy Deloney, who's hopefully awake with us today. How are you, Guy?
Wide awake, thank you very much, and enjoying the first snows of winter.
Excellent stuff. Well, let's begin with some of the topics that are making the headlines there in your part of the world. Serbia, and it's a new gas pipeline.
Are you a fan of gas pipelines, Phil?
I love gas. Love gas.
I mean, to be frank, though, it's one of these things which is, you know, the stuff of everyday life. As I've mentioned, we've got here the first snows of winter. Well, a bit of natural gas would come in quite handy on those sort of occasions. And energy security, of course, a big issue across Europe. And a great big new gas pipeline called the South Stream is being constructed from Russia through to Western Europe, Austria, Slovakia and Italy, to be precise. But the big staging point on this is Serbia. And Serbia ceremonially welded its first two pipes together.
I love a ceremonial welding, Guy. That's my favourite sort of welding. What's in it for Serbia?
Very glamorous welding.
What's in it for Serbia, Guy?
Tens of thousands of jobs, they reckon. And as I mentioned, Serbia wouldn't just have this pipeline going through it. There wouldn't be tens of thousands of jobs in a pipe just sitting there. There's going to be gas storage facilities as well, and little branches going off hither and thither across the Western Balkans.
And how much, Guy, do you think this is Serbia trying to play a bit of regional power politics?
Now, it's funny you should say that. I actually had a chat with Prime Minister Ivica Dacic just before this ceremonial welding. And I said, you know, are you going to try and play a bit of politics? After all, Russia has been known to do that with its neighbours. And he just had a little twinkle in his eye and said, well, I have offered to build a pipeline to Kosovo if they want it. So I think, you know, the thought has certainly occurred to Serbia that they could do such a thing. Let's put it that way.
So this feeds into an idea that's emerging of Serbia of sort of playing a bit of a political balancing act between East and West.
Yeah, I think they'd love to do that. At the moment, they're really enjoying it, I think, in a way that they can say that we've got these European Union membership talks coming up in the new year. We've got free trade agreements with the EU, with Russia, with Turkey, and it's time to take advantage of that. And funnily enough, it may be a limited window because, of course, once it becomes an EU member, it may have to give up on some of these free trade agreements with other areas. It also doesn't want to give up on its long-time friendship with Russia. So this is crucial. This is all 51% funded by Gazprom, the Russian energy giant. So this is a way of Serbia saying, look, we might be going towards EU membership, but at the same time, we're very keen to keep our friendship with Russia. And this is an enormous symbol of that, a pipeline-sized symbol of that.
Guy, let's move on to another topic. Of course, football very big in your part of the world. Dom and I are very big football fans here at Midori House. We're very polite, though, well-mannered. Not so, though, in the Balkans.
Absolutely not. The latest one to cause an issue came during World Cup qualification last week. Croatia defeating the mighty Iceland 2-0 at their home stadium in Zagreb, at which one of their most experienced players, Josip Simenic, a defender, 35 years old, should know better, takes to the stadium microphone and shouts, Zadom, to which the entire stadium replied, Spremni. Now, this means for country and then ready. And unfortunately, this is the fascist salute used by the Ustasha, the Croatian fascists, during the Second World War. And, of course, many people in these parts haven't forgotten that the Ustasha committed genocide against hundreds of thousands of people, Serbs, Roma, Jews. So to go shouting this at a stadium isn't very helpful at all. We've got FIFA, football's world governing body, allegedly investigating, but we know what FIFA investigations into racism are like.
Deary me, that is very unpleasant indeed. And elsewhere in the region, Serbian fans also getting it in the neck.
Yes, it seems the government has finally had enough of these very fighty football matches we tend to get here, particularly between Partizan and Red Star Belgrade. And they've said they're going to crack down on the hooligans. Now, the spanner in the works here is that the hooligan groups have long been used as goon squads, as muscle, by the various political parties. So for the government to say that they're going to try and crack down on the hooligan groups effectively means they're going to have to do something about people who've been, you know, support for hire for their own parties or the parties that are in government currently, and indeed the opposition, over a period of many years. So that's going to be an enormous paradigm shift.
And finally, Guy, Kosovo heading back to the polls.
Yes, it's black comedy. This weekend we've got the mayoral runoffs in Kosovo, in all the various municipalities. In one place, though, they're having to do it all over again, these local elections, these supposedly groundbreaking local elections for the Serb communities in North Kosovo. They're having to try again, this time in a municipality called Zvečan, because the OSCE, the security organization which was meant to be overseeing the election, managed to leave behind the ballot boxes during the original election earlier this month. You really couldn't make it up.
Excellent stuff, Guy. We're going to leave it there, unfortunately. Guy Delaney, our man in Belgrade, thanks for joining us on the program.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
And in the next half hour of the program, we'll be reviewing the European front pages with Alexa Firmenich, and we'll also celebrate the 25th anniversary of the Danube Island in Vienna.
The island is still free of building development, and it's accessible for everybody, and it's definitely a success.
So a very busy second half of the program here on Midori House, but first here is Barney Burnham with the news headlines.
Thanks, Phil. President Obama has taken on domestic critics of a newly brokered nuclear deal with Iran, which the US and its partners say will prevent Tehran from obtaining a nuclear bomb. The president said tough talk was good for politics, but not good for US security. The UN Deputy Secretary General has called on the Security Council to consider deploying UN peacekeeping forces to the Central African Republic. Jan Eliasson says the area has become a breeding ground for extremists and armed groups. The jailed Ukrainian opposition leader and former Prime Minister Yulia Tymoshenko has gone on a hunger strike to push President Viktor Yanukovych to sign a landmark trade agreement with the European Union. An official report into last year's school shooting in Newtown, Connecticut, has found that the gunman was obsessed with the 1999 massacre at Columbine. After killing his mother, Adam Lanza went on to kill 20 young children and 6 adults at Sandy Hook Elementary School on the 14th of December last year before he shot himself. Documents published by the Roman Catholic Church in Scotland have revealed details of abuse allegations made between 2006 and 2012. The church says it will now carry out an audit of its archives dating back to 1947, and it will alert the police if there's any evidence of abuse by priests being covered up over the last 60 years. Delegates at the annual meeting of the International Commission for the Conservation of Atlantic Tunas have agreed on freezing fishing quotas for bluefin tuna in 2014. The World Wildlife Fund has welcomed the decision to keep the quota unchanged. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, Barney. Barney will be back at the top of the hour with another check of your world headlines. But in the meantime, you are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Phil Hahn, and Dominic Reynolds. Now, Vienna's location alongside the flood-prone Danube River had seen generations of engineers racking their brains as to how best to protect the city from high water, work that culminated in the late 1980s with the creation of the 20-kilometer-long Danube Island that split the river in half.
And since then, the island's become one of the Austrian capital's best-loved leisure areas. But even today, as the island celebrates the 25th anniversary of its construction, there's still controversy over its status. Well, Monocle's Alexei Korolev has more for this week's Section D.
The place is the Danube Island. The time, June this year. The Donauinsel Fest, Europe's biggest annual open-air festival, is in full swing. It's the festival's 30th anniversary, with visitor numbers reaching a record 3.2 million, nearly twice Vienna's entire population. But recreation was not exactly the Danube Island's original purpose. The island was the result of decades of engineering efforts to regulate the flow of the Danube River. Some of the earliest schemes to protect Vienna from flooding date back to the late 19th century.
Until the first half of the 19th century, the Danube River was just a wild river.
Harald Erber is one of the island's original creators.
So the Danube River parted in many branches, and it was necessary, and all these branches had to be transmitted by bridges. And high water destroyed in many times destroyed bridges. So they built the so-called Durchstich, breakthrough. One straight riverbed instead of all these branches.
The central riverbed and a specially designed inundation area next to it were just about enough to keep the floods at bay well into the 1950s. But Vienna's rapid post-war growth called for new ideas. It was architect August Zottl, Harald Erbe's senior partner, who came up with the most ingenious one.
The idea of Mr. Dr. August Zottl was to build, to dig a second riverbed parallel to the main bed and deposit the digged material between the main riverbed and the new riverbed. So the second riverbed, the new Danube, called later on called the New Danube, had to be closed and just opened for high water flow.
The island and the New Danube were completed in 1988, but already during their construction there had been much controversy about what to do with the island's vast grounds. Astonishingly, the city authorities withdrew their earlier construction tender and proclaimed Alles für jedermann zur Verfügung. It's for everybody to have and enjoy.
At that time I took part in this competition and did not believe in the concept that this area, this island, would be kept free from buildings and compromises with representational uses and so on forever.
Architect Hermann Tschech had another vision.
I envisaged the possibility that this not privately owned strip of land should be taken up for solving the housing problem of the decade after.
His colleague Stefan Hübner even suggested a different shape for the New Danube.
Wir haben also damals vorgeschlagen, die Donauinsel nicht.
I proposed not to run the new raceway parallel to the Danube, Hübner says, but to bend it in the middle, so as to create an area which could be used for housing.
Einen Bogen zu machen, und zwar der Bogen wäre gewesen.
But despite the Viennese authorities' commitment not to allow any construction on the island, Hübner says it's something that must happen.
Und es ist keine adäquate Nutzung in diesem Bereich. Es gibt dort.
The area is not being used adequately, he says. We must build some decent architecture there instead of these sailing clubs and hot dog stands. Hermann Tschech is, however, less critical.
I was wrong. The island is still free of building development and it's accessible for everybody and it's definitely a success. And I used to say, if in city planning, if a mistake is big enough, then later on it's called city development. And this has also been true here.
25 years on, the Danube Island still provokes debate. Vienna's Architekturzentrum, the architecture museum, held a panel discussion earlier this month to mark the island's anniversary.
So we've had these plans to make the Donauinsel a topic ever since the spring of this year, basically.
Caroline Meyer coordinated the event.
I think the curiosity comes because we generally think that a project like that would not be possible anymore today, because the economic interests would be so strong that land gained would definitely be building land, and the waterfront would be a fantastic site for luxury housing, basically.
Meyer says it's important that younger generations know just what a feat of engineering the island really was.
I think everybody my age and older knows that it's an artificial island, but I can imagine that younger people don't know that anymore. The danger is that the future generations will forget that it is actually a flood protection project. I think it is pretty unique.
For Monocle in Vienna, I'm Alexei Korolev.
And you are listening to Midori House. After this very short break, we're off to the New England coast, the imaginary home of Moby Dick, to discuss what commercial fishing is really like in real life.
Monocle's latest collaboration with Comme des Garçons results in a light, energizing, and refreshing unisex perfume, titled and inspired by Japanese cedar Sugi. It has top notes of Mediterranean cypress and pepper from Madagascar, a hint of iris from Florence, and cedar from Virginia. With a bottle designed by Monocle's own designers, Scent 3, Sugi, is the long-awaited addition to Monocle's fragrance collection. Available in all five Monocle shops, Dover Street Market in London and Tokyo, and of course, online at monocle.com/shop.
The entrepreneur seeks out the seers, the sages, and the successes of the business world. Every week, we take you on an hour-long tour to uncover the hidden, extraordinary, curious, and inspiring stories you won't hear anywhere else.
I don't see any borders between countries, if it's in Japan, England, France. My approach is that I believe that people anywhere in the world, there are people who understand and appreciate it.
There's a push maybe that people want to have more of their stuff made locally because they know where it's coming from.
From the kiosk owners of Cairo to the coffee culture of Tel Aviv, from the beer brewers of Ghana to the piano makers of Greece. Intrigued? Well, tune in to hear how the best entrepreneurial minds tick, not just the ups and downs of the FTSE.
We didn't buy into a design studio or a commercial entity, we bought into a factory.
So, if you have an idea and want to drop that 9-to-5, you've just found your new business Bible.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time, in association with Pictet.
Welcome back. You're listening to Midori House. The time is 8:41 here in London. Now, for the less religious of our listeners, here is a reminder. Leviathan is a biblical sea monster, a legendary creature that engulfs the world. Sounds scary, huh?
I'm a little bit scared.
Are you frightened?
Yeah.
Well, it's also the inspiration for Herman Melville's terrifying whale, Moby Dick. And now it's the name of a new experimental documentary on commercial fishing.
Now, Lucien Castang-Taylor and Verena Paravel are two anthropologists and documentary filmmakers, and they followed fishermen off the coast of New England, Massachusetts, where Melville's Moby Dick, of course, is set. Their film reflects the brutal realities of deep-sea fishing with a visually arresting technique. A camera fixed, imagine this, Phil, a camera fixed on every part of the ship. Are you with me?
I'm here.
Designed to immerse the viewer, literally, in the lives of the fishermen portrayed in the feature. You see what they've done there. So, does the film aim to make you seasick?
I feel a bit sick right now.
Yeah?
Yeah, just because thinking
about
it.
Because of the way I've read it or because of
it
the idea?
It was very emotive.
Good. Mm. Well, it's like a sort of audio version of Gravity, the movies. Yes. This is the radio equivalent. Well, a little earlier, Monocle's researcher Fernando Augusto Pacheco spoke to Castang-Taylor and to Paravel, the directors of Leviathan.
This is the first time we're making a film together, but we have been working together in the past at the Sensory Ethnography Lab. We were discussing work together and we share idea and a camera sometimes and sound device sometimes. So it's like our collaboration started intellectually before, but like practically for this film.
How did you divide the work, for example, Lucia?
We're not professional filmmakers, professional artists, professional anthropologists. And so we just invent ourselves on the fly, in a sense. And I would say that we both do everything. It's not as if one of us does sound and one of us does picture. We take turns with the camera. We take turns doing sound. We both edit together, go in and out of the edit room.
And where did the idea came from for the film, which is about the fishing industry? But it's shot in such a beautiful way. I mean, can you tell us a little bit more about what did you want to show with this film?
I don't think we knew before doing the film. We knew few things. We knew that we had an interest in a city, which is the New Bedford. Very interesting city, history, related to the whaling time. And we knew we had interest in portraying the sea, our relationship to the sea, metaphysical, physical. We knew that there were tons of other art or work that have been doing that before, and we knew that we were interested in trying to do something a little bit different, less romantic maybe. This we knew. We didn't know exactly how we would handle the job.
You had to change the location. I believe you first wanted to do on land.
Yes.
But then you changed your mind.
Yes.
During the...
Yeah. And no wonder. I mean, like, everything was on land was super interesting. I mean, it is in a very fascinating industry. But just something as simple as being at sea takes you in a different mind space and, you know, also the experience is completely overwhelming. And I think there is nothing that everything we have done on land just kind of disappear in front of the intensity of what was going on there. And suddenly the men you have been filming on land became something else, because they're just those men, like, taken with the element and other things. So it suddenly become another major things that you have in front of you and you need to tackle.
You mentioned that you both have connections with the sea. What is this connection?
I grew up in Liverpool, where my father was working in the ship industry, building ships and working in the port. And I used to go out on various boats with him as a kid, but I didn't, you know, as a kid, I didn't really understand it. And then I grew up and left home and left the country. And my earlier work has not really been obviously autobiographical in some way. And Leviathan isn't obviously autobiographical for either of us, but I think we were both interested in doing something to which we had some personal connection.
Yeah, in my case, it's more like the curiosity about the deep, what is below. My father traveled a lot and took us everywhere where he was working. Every single time we would travel and we would be close to the sea, he would buy a boat, like a tiny boat, and he would go and do harpooning. And so I spent hours and hours, like, just waiting for him to re-emerge from below there, wondering where he was and if he was still alive and if we had caught something. So it's like a wandering. I think this is what really triggered my imagination about the sea. And this is my closest, you know, relationship to the sea.
And talking about the film as well, I mean, when I watched, I mean, it seems to me that some parts are quite brutal. And I believe it was a very difficult film to direct.
Direct is actually a word that we never use ourselves, because we don't know what we are doing, but we don't feel like we are directing anything, but we are trying. So basically in that case, it was mostly trying to be safe and capture everything that we could all around us. Physically, I cannot say that it was not difficult. Both being a little bit sick. I mean, Lucien was seasick. I was not, but I was suffering from, you know, the violence, like maybe more of the violence of the sea on my body. But also maybe the noise, the sound, the persistent, loud engine noise was very nerve-wracking for everybody, you know? Not only us. I think the fishermen are also suffering from that. So that was difficult. And so, and emotionally too, of course, because, you know, you feel at once very isolated, but also very, there is a over sociality.
And on the technical side, Lucien, for example, which types of camera did you use? Because the images of the film are very, very beautiful, I have to say.
Well, just as we started off filming on land and ended up filming and editing exclusively with the images we shot at sea, likewise, we started off filming with regular high-definition cameras that we were holding ourselves that are semi-professional. But even from the first voyage, we were interested in experimenting with the fishermen in some way to come up with some kind of communal portrait in which they were invested themselves, in which way they were co-authors in a sense. And so we brought with us these extreme sports cameras that are now all the rage. So and we put them on the heads of different fishermen or on their chests or on their wrists, mostly on their heads. The lion's share of the film ended up being shot by these cameras, either that we would handhold or that we would attach to the bodies of the fishermen. And they also recorded really interesting. I mean, it's quite a compressed image, and you're out there in the thick of night in the middle of the Atlantic, and the sea is black, the sky is black. The only source of light are these incredibly strong cold lights on the boat that shine on the deck so they can work 24/7. So you have these cold lights with black all around you and very little distance that you can see, and all the fishermen are wearing these orange slickers and so on. So you have these kind of psychedelic colors that gets further away from sort of realism and naturalism and into a different space of opacity and abstraction.
A little look. World of directors of Leviathan, Lucien Castan-Taylor and Verena Paravel. They've been looking into the world of fishing for their documentary, Leviathan. The
film. Scary.
Yeah, you think so?
Well, would you rather be stuck underwater, deep in the ocean, or right, deep into space? Since you mentioned gravity a little earlier.
Right, okay, it's pretty tenuous. I think in space, because there's at least hope of survival, but unless I grow gills, it's not going to happen underwater.
And at least in space you have a view, so if you're going to go, you might as well go with a nice view, right?
There we go. I think you've been quite influenced by watching Gravity. You were impressed by this film, weren't you?
Yeah, it was good.
Okay, good. That was Phil talking about underwater versus space. Now, Leviathan, which we were talking about, that film will be released in cinemas in the UK on Friday, followed by a DVD release quite soon afterwards on the 9th of December by Dogworth. In a moment, we will be reviewing French, Spanish and Swiss front pages with Alexa Firmenich. She's coming in shortly. But first, to get us there and given the francophone twist of the upcoming newspaper review, we thought we'd play you some French music. This is Julien Doré with Paris Seychelles. Et puis se taire, le désir encore pour l'hiver, un chaos d'efforts sur Saint-Hilaire. On s'était dit des choses que l'on ne tiendra pas. Le temps que l'on se pose sur nos lauriers mayas. On s'était dit des choses. That was Julien Doré with Paris Seychelles.
And you are listening to Midori House with me, Phil Hahn, and Dominic Reynolds. We're joined now in the studio by Monocle's Alexa Firmenich, who has been reading some of the European front pages this morning. Welcome to the program. How are you?
Good, good, Phil. Welcome back.
Oh, thank you.
Oh, yeah, welcome back, Phil.
Thanks, Dom.
Didn't notice you'd been away.
Well, let's just stick to Alexa for now, shall we? What have you got for us?
So, in El País, the leading story in Spanish press is that Carlos Fabra, who is a top ally of the Prime Minister of Spain, Rajoy, he was convicted yesterday of tax evasion and sentenced to 4 years in jail for tax fraud. And this is just yet another corruption scandal for Spain. It's the last thing they need there right now as well.
Yeah, it's pretty tough. So Mariano Rajoy is looking on rather dodgy ground. People looking at him with an air of suspicion at the moment.
I mean, there's so many other potential political scandals just waiting. There's a few other guys as well in the pipeline who are being investigated. But this guy, Carlos Fabra, he's a very interesting character. He always appears, I don't know if you've seen pictures of him in the press, wearing dark glasses.
Yeah, he likes his shades, doesn't he?
And so he was basically the leader of Castellón, of the PP party in Castellón. And that's the part of Valencia, which is a part of the country where the 2008 crisis, the construction crisis, was hit most strongly. Mm. And actually, he oversaw really controversial public spending projects there. Mm. There was the construction of an airport that remains derelict and empty. And he says that the airport was for the people of Castellón, not just for planes. And he tried to turn it into a sort of airport tourism. And there's a huge statue of himself in front of the airport that cost around €500,000 to build.
Wow. I love sort of demented narcissism like that. I think it's great. Am I right in thinking he's won the lottery on several occasions?
Yeah, several times. Around 7, 8, 9 times.
Obviously. I mean, because lots of people win more than once. Has he been struck by lightning 9 times as well? Unbelievable. If I was trying to appear credible and not someone who's going to go the wrong way in a corruption scandal, I wouldn't wear dark glasses all the time.
Or
I
would have a statue built after yourself.
Yeah,
or win the lottery so many times. People were saying that's a way of laundering money. And
Does the statue have dark glasses on, by the way?
You know what? I don't know, but there's a picture of it somewhere. Okay. We should dig it up.
We'll have a look later.
You've also got the Spanish paper El País for us, and an interesting story here about the Danish royal family.
Well, I don't know if you've seen this picture. It's quite funny. It was commissioned by the Danish royal family, and it's one of the first portraits of the family in over 125 years. To celebrate,
it's very spooky. It's like reign. The Addams Family.
Well, that's what all of the press is saying. Yeah, they're
it's
getting
like a sort of poster for horror movie with one of the younger members of the family, a small boy, front and center and kind of lit from above in this quite frightening way.
Almost demonic eyes as well.
Yeah, it's, it sort of recalls The Omen slightly, which is not what you want to go for, or The Shining exactly.
No, that's the son Christian, the eldest son, and he's supposed to look like that because that's his conscience of his future responsibilities that are
as the devil.
Face.
Yes, as the Lord of Darkness, which is coming his way. So, I mean, I can see what they've done with the sort of the composition of this, but I don't think it's particularly flattering.
It's just strange. It
wouldn't make people feel love for their royal family, would it?
And Alexa, finally, you have a story for us from France, this time about the Eiffel Tower. Now, I was in Paris just a couple of days ago, your hometown.
Were you taking part of this particular sale of the steps of the Eiffel Tower?
No, but I did go to the Eiffel Tower.
Yeah,
just by coincidence.
Well, now you can actually buy a piece of the Eiffel Tower for yourself. There was a 19-step section of the tower that was sold at an auction. It's quite funny. They thought it would fetch around 30,000 euros, but it actually fetched around 170,000. So a very, very, very steep price for these steps sold to a Portuguese collector.
I mean, presumably that tells us something about the way that the tower is now sort of has evolved fully in the minds of Parisians and the art world more generally. It is now much more loved than it was thought at one stage it would be.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just buying a piece of such an iconic part of a country. You own the steps of Eiffel Tower, put them in your garden, in your home. I don't know what he's going to do with them, but...
That's an expensive garden gnome.
Yeah, it is.
Well, thanks very much, Alexa, for having a flick through this morning's European front pages, as always. Well, unfortunately, though, that is all the time we have for today's program. Thanks to our producer, Daphne Adeni, whose hometown is also in Paris, I think. It's a bit of a Francophile love in here. Yeah. Our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and Iona McLaren, and also very talented studio manager, Bill Luthi. Up next, after the news, is The Entrepreneurs with Sophie Grove. And of course, stay tuned for The Briefing at midday in London. That's 7 a.m. in New York. I'll be back with Tag Enright from Midori House at the same time tomorrow. But for now, from me, Phil Hahn.
And from me, Dominic Reynolds. Thank you for listening. Goodbye.
Why this watch? This watch is a witness to words that moved nations. It's dead men faster, further. It's been worn by luminaries, visionaries, champions. It doesn't just tell time, it tells history. Rolex.